Hello, everybody. Today, we are here with one of the most beloved professors in the university. He is the director of the Complex Human Data Hub, the coordinator of the third year psych subject RMHI, and the creator of Bunnyland, Professor Andy Perfors. How are you today, Andy?
Good. Thanks for having me on this. I think it'll be interesting.
It surely, hopefully will. We're also here with Adam today. Adam, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks, Ro.
So today our main topic is neurodivergence in academia. And the term neurodivergence is, of course, a very broad term that goes beyond a clinical definition. Although it is, of course, connected to various clinical conditions, various researchers have stated it is, in fact, a difficult term to define. How would you personally describe neurodivergence, Andy?
Oh, that's a really good question. For myself, well, I guess my internal definition is kind of a weirdo. And I mean this in a very affectionate way. Like, I think pretty much most of my family is divergent and neurodivergent in one way or another, and so am I. But what it does is it captures that sense of there's actually multiple ways and many different ways to be neurodivergent. I suppose classically it's autism, ADHD, and of course those things overlap quite a lot. But I think there's other ways of being neurodivergent as well. I mean, dyslexia and things like that, which again, also, a lot of these are very comorbid and correlated, and I don't know, we could have a long digression about the nature of, I think this is the whole topic of psychopathology, right? The nature of, are these separable things, are they not, does it even make sense to talk about them as conditions, and I won't even go down there. But I also think, I guess I think of it as just a way that the way you think is different than the norm. And if you think of that, the norm is obviously no one's exactly the norm, but someone that we would say is neurodivergent to the extent that I think it, you know, it affects you to the point that you, it's sensible to identify that way. You know, I'm going to bring statistics in this. You're several standard deviations away, right, on whatever the relevant dimension is. Yeah. So I guess that's kind of how I think, but I really, you know, it's not my area of interest studying it. Obviously, I know a lot because of my own personal experience with it, and being a psych professor, you can't help but pick up stuff. But I will probably say things that someone who actually studied this would be like, no, that's not quite right. My little personal thing is, yeah, you kind of know it when you see it, you know? Yeah.
So you consider yourself neurodivergent?
Yeah. Exactly how? Like, well, I do. The reason I'm hesitating here is I think it's very, is my age. You know, when I grew up, there was just not as much understanding of that at all. Like, people had heard of autism or ADHD, but they were considered extremely fringe, very weird things. And so I never considered myself neurodivergent. I mean, again, I think half my family is. None of us did. And so I didn't really internalize that as a thing about myself until probably the last 10 years or so in trying to make, I mean, I was, and so I was diagnosed with ADHD in my early 20s, which is more than 10 years ago. But even then, I didn't really change the way I viewed myself. It was like, oh, this makes it things work better. But I almost aggressively did not think about what that meant about me. Because again, even then, 20 years ago, it was changing a little bit, but there was not this widespread knowledge of what that meant. In academia, I didn't know anyone who had ADD. I didn't want to admit that I had ADD. And I didn't want to, you know, half of me wavered between thinking, it's not even a real thing, and I've managed to persuade some doctor to give me medicine that helped, and I feel like a cheat now. And the other thing was like, what if this is a big thing and I really don't want to know? So I like aggressively did not even think about it at all. And so it's really only in the past 10 years that I've gotten older. People are starting to talk about it more. I see it in my kids. And that's really made me have to think about, you know, what it means, what's the best way to deal with it, that I've started thinking about it for with myself. And also I've been in therapy and turns out that there's a lot of stuff that can be explained about me by and through the lens of neurodivergence. So yeah. So ADD, and in my family there's very, I wouldn't say I'm autistic, but we're, you know, insofar as it's a spectrum, we're probably closer to the autistic end.
I personally, myself, and I feel like many other people around me have at times contemplated if we are neurodivergent ourselves. Sometimes we decide to check if we are, sometimes we don't. Or like how neurodivergent we are. It's always a question. Yes. Why do you think it is so common for us to consider our individual differences in mentality and brain chemistry?
Well, I think, I think for one thing, it's pretty common. Well, it's probably more common among psych students than among other people, because that's, you know, almost by definition, we're selecting for people who are kind of interested in how the brain works. I think also, though, there might be slightly more neurodivergent people in psych than elsewhere, because those, like, you end up thinking about how your brain works more when you notice that the differences between that and the norm that's expected, right? So, like, you know, even if you didn't have words for it, which I didn't, you know, what I had words for were, I'm a weirdo. and I meant it much more pejoratively than I now think of it. But it was just like, that's not right. You know, I'm having all the wrong inside thoughts from what you're supposed to do. And so I feel like, you know, I don't know, it's natural. You notice enough of that and you think, why? What's going on there? You know, I was actually raised pretty religiously. And one of my thoughts that wasn't quite right was that I just could not get myself to believe in God, or not even that, just stop questioning. Like, they'd say that, and I'd be like, but why? But that doesn't make sense. And they're like, no, you're not supposed to think that way, you know? And so I had this meta thing from very early on of, like, why am I thinking that way? You know, why am I? And, of course, when you're raised religiously, the obvious answer is it's because of the devil, you know? And that... Well, obviously, I was like, no, that can't be right, you know. But I thought for a while it could be right. But anyways, the point is, you can't stop yourself from asking why when you notice these differences. And I also think that some aspects of neurodiversity, you know, one of the, so if you're, you know, if you're kind of autistic spectrum-y or something, you know, you do grab these questions and you can't let them go, right? And so. I think that might be part of it. But I honestly think, you know, almost any kind of neurodiversity would do that. So, for instance, my Nunu, my grandfather, he was very severely dyslexic. And, you know, I mean, he died 20 years ago. He was born in 1920. Like, this was a time where that was, you know. And he was this very, very quiet, extraordinarily bright guy who couldn't read, but back then, you didn't have to read as much. He was, like, a very successful engineer. But, you know, like, that's a very different kind of neurodiversity, very different time period. And yet he often would, like, when I started studying cognitive science, he'd be like, so, well, what is that? Like, he had lots of questions. And you could tell some of it was fueled by this sense that he always had that he was different. He never had words for it. Yeah.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
I was also raised religious, and I'm not religious anymore. So I definitely understand the struggle to be a bit different than what's typical when you're raised in a religious environment.
Yeah.
How do you find that kind of shapes your psychology or the way you look at the world? Because I might be picking up on things, but it sounds like you did struggle quite a lot with the idea of neurodiversity. Not really, because, like, the devil or, yeah. So is it even okay? Is it acceptable to be different from the norm? And I guess under a lot of religious environments, that's kind of like, almost frowned upon.
Yeah.
How did that shape you growing up?
I mean, that's a really good question. I think that was, like, when I think of, you know, my life, there was a series of points at which I kind of broke with what my family expected of me. That was probably one of the biggest first ones. And after that, it was me going to, me going to university. That's not quite right. My family supported education, but it was all in the sense of you do, and then you come back, and you know, and the idea of me going to Stanford and then going off into the Ivy Leagues and becoming this sort of, you know, weird academic, that was not quite, you know, and so that was a divergence, and then coming out as queer was a divergence, and then moving to Australia, and so it was just this series of little breaks with how I was raised, and I think that was kind of one of the first ones, and I think what all of that did is it sort of built in me this I don't know what's cause and what's effect, honestly, but this automatic question of like, oh, well, that's the norm, but why? And does it make sense? And does that, even if it's a norm, should that be my norm? And so now I feel like I'm almost reflexively the other way. Like if like, you know, I feel weird if I feel like I belong somewhere, like what's wrong? Where's the, you know, this something's going to be, you know, like it's almost pathological the other direction because I've had so many instances where that doesn't happen. But I also think that what that's done is it's actually really good training to be a scientist in some way, right? Because what you do is you just start, it's your default of, I want to understand why. And just because people say that's that way, that doesn't mean it has to be that way. And then also, just because it's that way for most people doesn't mean it has to be that way for me. So I think that's kind of what, you know, yeah. Again, what's cause and what's effect? But I think that's it's not a surprise I ended up in science, I guess is what I'm saying. Yeah. I don't know if that answered your question at all.
Oh, no, definitely. Yeah. So, yeah, and it's interesting you say that it, I guess it does make sense that it kind of trained you to be very critical, which is important in science, not automatically accept prior conclusions or assumptions.
Yeah. And it's interesting, though, in science that because it's really important you be critical, but it's also really important that you play and that you be willing to sort of, like a failure mode, the other failure mode I see with people is that they're too critical too soon for everything, right? And a lot of things sound stupid when you first hear them or before you flesh it out or whatever. And so there's this really other sense in which you need to be like, okay, I'm going to, this idea is a weird idea. I'm just going to play with it and follow it through. And to some extent, I think neurodivergence or being comfortable with being neurodivergent helps you there because it's like, that's weird. That's okay. I'm just going to sort of, other people might think this is weird. That's okay. I'm just going to play with it. And just being willing to play with things is the other flip side of science. So you have to balance those. But I think in both cases, I wouldn't say necessarily neurodivergence is the secret power, but being comfortable with being different is the secret power. Bunnyland's actually a great example of that, right? I came up with that and I was like, this is weird, but, you know, I'm just going to play with it. And honestly, the main reason I did is it made it more fun for me. And I was like, well, they're just going to have to deal, you know? And it worked, yeah.
I feel like at the start of RMHI, all of us were a bit confused at Bunnyland. And afterwards, like, after you get used to it, you just can't live without it, you know?
Yeah, no, it very much is in it. Those poor first year I did it because, like, you know, at least later years, you know it's coming and, you know, previous students have said, no, hang in there. It's, you know, the first years, which was also the COVID year, I think they were like, what the, I will not say this, you know, curse word, you know, like, what is going on? But it was also COVID, so everyone was just like, whatever, we're just going to hang on in there. And I think that was actually really good that the first year was the COVID year. And, you know, yeah.
They were the guinea pigs.
Yeah. The bunny pigs, yeah. Anyways, it worked a lot better than I thought it would. I thought it most people would, our lecturer's doing this, we have to put up with it, and some people might like it, and it was, but it was really, I think what surprised me about how much people liked it is, so the other reason I did it is because I really think it helps with data analysis to have a purpose for the data analysis, right? And so the story gives you a purpose. The thing that surprised me was that, so I had all these characters, and again, I did this all for myself. I was like, there's different characters, and they have different personalities, and it was like, you know, my weird way of writing fan fiction while getting paid for it by the university, you know. But what I think surprised me was that people liked the characters and sort of it helped people feel not alone in doing stats of like, you know, well, yeah. And so that was really nice. Yeah.
I must say I laughed quite a bit when Kevin came into the picture for the very first time. I'm glad that you actually brought up data analysis because, of course, students know you from RMHI and your area of study is computational cognitive science. Mm-hmm. Is there any research into neurodivergence through computational psychology?
That's a very good question. I think there's, so again, this is sort of the, so in my area of computational cognitive science, no, because what we are generally trying, we're far more basic than that. We're generally trying to say, in the normal case, when people are, you know, making inferences about really, really easy things, what are they doing? And can we compare that to, like, what we'd expect, like, an ideal statistical model to be doing? So the idea of figuring out neurodivergence in that is just several steps beyond there. That said, there's a whole area of computational psychiatry that I think is touching on some of that. And I definitely have given thought, and I know researchers have given thought to how within what we do, you could account for neurodivergence. So I mean, this is all speculative, so no one go find papers that say that. But just to give you an idea, one of the standard models of attention basically says that what an organism is doing when it's trying to pay attention is it's trying to find the areas in the environment with the most potential information gain, right? You want to look the place where you're going to learn the most, right? And so you can think of it as you have a map of sort of where there's the most potential gain, and then you turn to look there, and then once you've learned enough there, then you move on, right? And so I was like, well, what if ADD is just a variant on that, right? Because there's different parameters you can turn of, like, how quickly do you get bored, right? And so I think you could probably understand neurodivergence, some kinds of neurodivergence, in ways like that, as variations on the sort of standard. But again, I don't know. There might be people who are actually trying to do that, because I wouldn't necessarily know if there are. But I think there's scope for that kind of thing to, even if there aren't now, to lay into there. I do think most of the people who currently work on neurodivergence is much more applied stuff, right? It's like, how do we, you know, how do we come up with good programs for them? How do we figure out who's actually neurodivergent? How do we figure out, and not in a theoretical sense of what's going on in their brain, but rather sort of how do we diagnose the people who will be most helped by this or that, that kind of thing. It's much more applied, and I know less about that. Yeah,
that's super interesting. Speaking about the more applied things, mm-hmm. Personally, as someone who is neurodivergent, and also from your knowledge, which I'm sure is greater than ours, what do you think are the main barriers or obstacles for neurodivergent people who want to become academics or researchers?
Now, that's a really good question. So here, I think it probably depends a bit on the kind of neurodivergence. So I'll speak about the kinds I've thought most about, which is ADD and autism. I think so one of the barriers, which applies to all of them, is if people just immediately write it off as a possibility and say, oh, there's no way I could succeed in academia because I'm neurodivergent. And part of why I want to go on this podcast and stuff is to be like, nope, that's not true, right? And in fact, I think a lot of people in academia who are professors are some flavor of neurodivergent.
I noticed that.
Yeah.
I didn't expect that coming into academia, and now it's like, that's the norm.
It just jumps out at you, yeah. I remember, I wasn't even using the words this way, but when I went to MIT, that's where I did my PhD, I was just like, wow, I am more normal than like 50% of people here, right? You know, and by normal, I clearly meant a sort of, I can mimic, you know, non-neurodivergence better than most, you know, and I mean, that's MIT, which is weird in many ways. But I think academia is like that. So it's definitely a good place for neurodivergent people. But I think if you have ADD, it really, you have to do a lot of thinking about ways that work for you to get shit done on time. And, you know, there's a lot of different ways of having ADD and a lot of different hacks. But I think that's something that I've often really struggled with. And I do the sort of standard thing still of panic is actually my main, you know, which works a lot better when you're 20 than when you're 40 and have a a family and you can't pull all-nighters as well and things like that. So luckily, I'm a lot better at it than I was. But I actually was pretty unhealthy in my 20s. And a lot of it was ADD caused, where I just sort of, I would do too much and leave everything for the last minute and then pull an all-nighter, and I could always pull it out and everything. But, it's just not that sustainable, really. But that said, in a way, it was also a secret strength, because the other way I got myself to do things, and this is very ADD, is I just did lots of different things, right? And so you do one thing, and then you get bored with it because you will, and then you do another thing. And I just had a lot of different things to do. And I actually found when I tried to be more sensible and just do fewer things, that actually was worse, because then I couldn't get the novelty. And so a lot of it, I'm totally meandering here. Probably this is very meta. but a lot of it is figuring out what works for you. And what worked for me is do a lot of different stuff, but have very hard deadlines that you don't let yourself, skate past. I actually, when I was in uni, they just didn't have extensions. And I also wasn't diagnosed with anything, so even if they did. And I think that was actually a secret, really good thing for me. I think if there'd been extensions, I would have just, it would not have helped me at all. Having the firm deadlines actually helped me keep control of things. Other people work differently, but you have to have a real tight sense of what works for you and do that thing even if it's not. Because everyone's like, told me, you're doing too many things. But I knew if I do fewer things, that wouldn't help, right? And same thing with my research career, actually. If you look at my research, it's much more meandering than many people's research. Like, they have a nice, clear story of this is what they're doing. My story is, like, all over the place. And I finally just was like, I'll lean into that because that's what I do well. And so I am not one of these people who's going to be the world's expert on this tiny topic. I'm never going to be that person. But I am the person that lots of people want to collaborate with because I know a lot about a little things and I can stitch it together and I bring energy. So basically, yeah, you have to figure out what works for you and lean into that. I don't know. I think for people more on the spectrum, I actually think the kind of focus and obsession with topics it gives you is really a good fit for academia, honestly. The hard part there, though, is as you go higher up in academia, more and more is about social skills. Me and many of my friends, we have this joke of, like, I spent my entire life working to get a job where I could hide behind a computer and not have to deal with them. But now as a professor, what are the main things we do is we have to talk to lots of people. We have to persuade people to give us money. Oh, it's terrible. Teaching is actually really good for me in terms of my particular ways of doing things, but it does involve social interaction. And so I think some people who are spectrum, on the spectrum, they struggle with that. It's all learnable skills. You just have to realize that it's a skill you have to learn, and it doesn't come necessarily naturally. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a person that might be on the spectrum, or maybe, the idea of the spectrum means that everyone's on the spectrum.
Yeah.
But yeah.
On the spectrum. Yes, yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Or a person that is farther on the spectrum, but just has some, let's say, social skill issues, let's call it that way. It is learnable, you're saying. You can, once you reach the stage where you actually need to make connections and mm-hmm. network and talk to people and be quote-unquote extroverted or act in more extroverted ways, that is learnable. Mm. And that isn't necessarily a great reason to not pursue a career in academia.
Yeah. Yeah, it's learnable. And the nice thing about academic careers is that they're somewhat flexible in how much you have to do it, right? So, I can do the extroverted social things. It just takes a lot out of me. But I can basically, I know that about myself. So I have to do this one thing. Otherwise, I'll get my friend who, hates this really nerdy aspect of data analysis. I'll do his data analysis. He'll go to that meeting, right? And so you can actually, to some extent, vary how much you do those things. Or it gets a lot more subtle than that too, though. Because so, like, social skills wise, I actually really love presenting. You may have noticed, you know, like, I like being like, it doesn't trigger any of my, I have weird social skills, you know, things. I actually have a lot harder of a time in, you know, 5 to 10 person group discussions and things like that. And one of my colleagues is exactly the opposite. He hates presenting. Like, it's terrifying to him. But he's actually really good. So we just trade it off and, you know, like, I'll take all the presenting. He can do all of that, you know, like, so you can do that to some extent, but you have to know that about yourself. And yeah, and you do have to learn to some extent to compensate. But the other nice thing about academia is it rewards bluntness in a way that you know, other, so you can just bluntly say, look, I'm awkward, you know, or I couldn't tell, did you mean X or Y by that? Or like, you know, everyone's doing the polite, we gotta end this meeting, you say, all right, I'm off. You know, like, you can get away with that in academia much more than like business or something.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So yeah, I definitely would not, you know, if you were further on the spectrum, I would not think, you know, count myself out of academia because of that. Just be aware that it does take more social skills and more, I hate the word social skills, but, you know, person interactions than you might think. Yeah.
One, going back to, like, more, like, from an academic context, I feel like in academic research, it is common to exclude particular individuals who may skew experimental results. Of course, we talked about this a lot in RMHI, so to make a population that is not quote-unquote normative more normative in results. This includes the potential exclusion of people with disabilities connected to neurodivergence, such as ADHD or dyslexia. As researchers, how could we produce high-quality studies while also acknowledging and respecting neurodiversity, do you think?
Now, that's a very good question. I think that there is more and more of an acknowledgement of this as an issue, at least in my area of research. And part of that is because we have better technical techniques for dealing with it. So if you look at my webpage, and I don't actually suggest anyone do that, but there are multiple papers where the theme is essentially, look, people in the aggregate do X. But if you actually look at the individuals there, it's a collection of three different strategies, this, this, and this. And the reason that we can do that is that we can come up with models that's, you know, say, these are the three strategies, and we can fit them to it, right? So you can do a bit more nuanced version of what's, you know, of what's going on. And that's just because we have the techniques for doing that. And I think more and more people are recognizing that aggregate behavior, it's not just that it, you know, it hides some of the differences. It's that, in some sense, it's not even accurate, right? Almost no one is exactly the norm. Everyone is just a different collection of strategies, right? And so neurodivergence is a great example of that, but it's not like normal people are all the same either, right? There's different strategies. Yeah, I talk about strategies because a lot of the times in my work, it's like there's this task and people are doing different things on this task, and whether it's because of neurodivergence or something else, we don't know. But you know, the point is the same. I definitely think that as a field, we need to do that more and more. I think there's increasing recognition of it, particularly as we have the ability to have larger samples, because that's the other thing, right? If you have only 40 people in your experiment, then you don't have enough power to find, you know, say there's three really interesting different strategies in there. You don't have enough power to pick that up. You have 300, you can. And so for the kinds of tasks where you can get that kind of sample size, then we're seeing that more and more. But it is hard with things that are less cognitive-y, because with cognitive tasks, you know, yeah, we can get lots of people to do lots of questions over and over again, tedious sort of, you know, these things, and you can get that kind of power, but a lot of other things you can't.
Yeah, there's just more nuance when it comes to things like social situations and behaviors of that nature.
Yeah.
Actually, that raises a question that I have. Given that, so you have what you might call neurodiversity, but to what extent is that an actual thing that's different? I mean, and sure, to some extent it is, but to what extent is that a thing that's different versus just being a bit weird, being different from, like, you know, the most typical head of the spear person, you know, straight, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Because a lot of people might fall into the second camp, but I don't know, would they necessarily be neurodivergent? Perhaps. Maybe they're just, I guess, variants of the same thing, but yeah. That's what I'm trying to find out here.
No, it's a good question. I mean, I don't think that there's a clear answer. The way I think about it is, sorry, this is going to be a very nerdy way of thinking about it, is, you know, you can think of humans as, like, multidimensional space, where each dimension is, like, one kind of characteristic, right? So, like, you know, one might be, is your attention all over the place? Or one might be, you know, do you like quiet? Or, you know, like, but, you know, infinite number of these, right? And I feel like what neurodivergence is it's, like, a coherent cluster in that space, right? It's sort of where you've got multiple traits and they kind of stick together, right? These ones tend to occur together. But everyone, like no one, there is no single norm in that space. So everyone, whether neurodivergent or not, there's going to be some traits that they're outside of the norm on. And in fact, it would be probably statistically strangest to find someone who's exactly in the center of all possible traits, right? And so I think, you know, neurodivergence just means, yeah, there's a sensible cluster here, right? So, which means that if I know you have X trait, then I think, oh, you might have Y trait as well, right? But it's obviously very much a spectrum. And I think this is where it's really useful for even people who don't consider themselves neurodivergent to think about, you know, on what traits am I normal, on more of the norm, on what traits aren't. You know, what are my strengths? What are my weaknesses? But also just, you know, what are the traits? And so this is, again, a thing that I think makes it hard to be neurodivergent when you're a kid, because all you notice when you're a kid is I'm weird, I don't belong, or whatever. But it gives people who are neurodivergent, I think they have a step up on having to think about that about themselves, because you can, the less neurodivergent you are, the more you can skate by without having to think about that. But, you know, it hits everyone at some point. And we just get, you know, we've just had a lot of more practice by our mid-20s than someone who, you know, like, yeah, like my brother, who's a very, very, like, prom king, very, very stereotypical dude. But, you know, he kind of hit a point in his 20s where he was like, this isn't right. But he, you know, it hit him hard because he didn't have 10 years of grappling with it. Again, I've meandered, but I think that, yeah, I think the point is there is no such single thing as neurodivergence. It's still sensible to talk about clusters, but everyone can probably benefit from thinking about, you know, where they fall. Yeah.
Yeah, just think about where you're weird, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And really, you know, weird, you know, remove all the emotion from weird. Like, I actually love the word weird, and I, like, all my best friends are weirdos. I actually named my my Wi-Fi name in my house was Weird Outliers for a while, because I was like, we're the weird outliers. So I love that, but, you know, if you're bothered, like, my 9-year-old hates the word weird, and I say, yeah, I love you, you're so weird, and like, don't call me that, you know, but if it bothers you, just, you know, don't think about it as an emotional thing, right? It's just simply a descriptor of how many standard deviations you are away, yeah.
How do we focus on moving forward and also being true to where we come from?
Yeah, I think, gosh, you guys have a lot of good, hard questions. I think, for me, what I try to do is just figure out what are the core things that I don't want to forget and the core values that I want to be true to, and then let everything else fall where it may, right? Because, you know, the real world is super complex. We can't always be everything that we are. You have to sometimes, you know, fold yourself in and adapt, and everyone has to do that. And And I think that's not even necessarily a bad thing, right? Because, you know, like in relationships, for instance, if everyone was just like, you have to accept me for exactly who I am, you know, like that would be kind of a miserable relationship, right? You try to adapt to each other. So it's not necessarily bad. But what I try to do is adapt for the things that aren't so central to me. I'll enter the caveat that in some positions, it's a lot easier to get away with more than in others. And part of my life has been getting myself to a position where I can do this more and more, right? So the amount as a professor that I can be like, nope, I'm going to do this, is a lot more than when I was an undergrad. But even when I was an undergrad, I was like, okay, I want to get myself to a position where I can do this. But, you know, a trivial example would be, you know, clothes. So I'm trans. I presented as a woman for a while, but I never wanted to wear girl clothes, right? And I realized this was a deal breaker for me, like, you know, and I was like, I am never going to go into a career where I have to wear girl clothes, where I need to be able to wear jeans and a t-shirt. And this actually, you know, in a way that's a ridiculous value, but that was a very important value for me. And I was like, and that cut out a bunch of career options. And it wasn't actually about the jeans and the t-shirt. It was about, you know, being true to myself as much as I could. But that meant, though, that I was willing to give on other things. And so I guess that's the sort of, yeah, what I would say. So another more relevant example, I guess, might be, maybe Bunnyland, right? So I actually lobbied really hard to get RMHI. I was like, I really want to teach this. But I really want to teach it. I really want to have 10 weeks of it, not sort of, you know, 3 weeks. Because in most of the other subjects, it's sort of the lecturers have 3 or 4 weeks or so. And I was like, I can't teach it that way. Like, I need this whole, you know, it's basically, it's a coherent thing. I have this, and this was even before I'd thought of the bunnies, but it's a very coherent. And so I was like, you know, I will teach it under these conditions and take it or leave it, right? And so then, you know, they were like, you want to teach our stats class, take it, you know. But I was willing to sort of give on a lot of other things. I guess that's, I don't know if that's a good answer. But, you know, find the core things that you won't compromise on and then compromise on the others. Yeah.
I also wanted to ask on RMHI. It sounds like you took kind of a risk with that, like with the whole Bunnyland thing. Mm. Were you scared or worried that it wouldn't work out how you planned it to?
A little bit. But this is, again, where, like, I felt like I had the privilege as a more senior person to do that. So I was not only more senior, but I was also not a teaching specialist, which means that my continued contract wasn't contingent on my teaching in the same way. So I knew I had a lot of research success. So worst case, I taught it and the student evaluations were terrible. Even in that case, I would have a few years to try to, you know, recover it. And even if that didn't happen, then that would be quietly shuffled off and someone else could take it over and I would just have to do other teaching. Like, that was the worst case. So I felt willing to take that risk, especially because, you know, well, I thought it was not that likely to happen. Like, worst case, the real worst case in my head was that people would find Bunnyland kind of lame. But, you know, luckily, statistics is such a low bar anyways, you know, I thought, like, it wouldn't be much worse than, you know. So it didn't feel that risky in the sense of I was risking something deep, right? What I was actually risking was 10 weeks of what would feel like, you know, actually kind of unpleasant teaching as everyone hated me. But, you know, had I been like a first year teaching specialist, it's this job or else I lose my visa and I have to go back to my country and stuff, I probably wouldn't have risked that then, you know, even if I thought I was probably going to be fine. Yeah.
I feel like at the end it was almost like artistic thoughts. Like,
yeah, it was definitely, I mean, I do think actually, there's a bit of frustrated, you know, writer in me. Like, I didn't become a writer, but, like, this was my way of, like, you know, I'm going to inflict some of my, you know, world building on people. So, yeah. You might have.
I just wanted to go back to neurodiversity for a second. Because, of course, I feel like we have a duty to cater towards every single person, and that makes us having to cater towards every single person, meaning every single person who is in who is a part of the neurodiversity. In addition to catering to everybody who is neurodivergent, there are various challenges that everyone has to face in both academia and day-to-day life. How could we prepare people who have neurodiversity to overcome these obstacles that they may come across in an individual way, as a person who has had to, of course, go through that?
Yeah, I think there's two parts to that question. So one is in terms of just sort of creating a world that is, I guess, more comfortable for neurodivergent people. I actually think there's many people perceive a false choice there. Like it's either you cater for neurodivergent people or you make it more comfortable for the norm. And I think that's actually totally false because most things that make neurodivergent people more comfortable are actually also pretty good for people who aren't neurodivergent. So, partly because neurodiversity is so diverse, like there's so many ways of doing it. But I'll use RMHI as a couple examples because I actually, consciously tried to work this in. So one of the things that I try to do in RMHI a lot is teach everything in multiple ways. So there's pictures, there's words, there's equations, there's walking it through, right? And so all of the different kinds of learning styles, you have something to grab on. And most people are different flavors of each of those styles, but some of everything, right? And so what that means is you can use those different things to bootstrap the other ones up, right? Oh, I'm not quite sure I understand this, what Andy's saying in words, but there's a picture here. And so that makes the words makes more sense. And now that I've got the words, then that picks out this bit of the picture and the equation. And so it bootstraps itself up. And that helps everyone, not just neurodivergent people, right? Similarly, as much as was possible, like I tried to make, the exam not time pressured. That's because it's good for neurodivergent people to not be under time pressure. But frankly, it's good for everyone. Like I don't, ideally, everyone should have as much time as possible. And, you shouldn't even need to have extensions or, accommodations, which is extra time. Everyone should get as much time as they're, sorry, this is my philosophy. Yeah, that's another example. So I think in terms of making the world more open and comfortable for neurodivergent people, I think if we just make I think doing that makes the world better for everyone. Because again, everyone is kind of weird in a way. But also everyone can benefit from those things. There was a second part of your equation or your question, which was more sort of if you're neurodivergent, how do you, yeah.
Yeah, how can we, I guess,
yeah.
balance yeah. having people, like increasing the comfort of everybody and at the same time also having, preparing neurodivergent people or like for them to take care of themselves
yeah.
and go through the struggles of life unassisted.
Yeah. No, yeah. So, yeah, because the fact of the matter is that there's the ideal world and there's the world we live in. And it's like, how do we make it through the world we live in? And, I would not recommend my strategy, which was mask furiously for most of your life and then reach your adulthood and realize, oh, crap, I've been masking furiously and I'm all these very maladaptive things that you're trying to untangle in your 40s. It succeeds on some level, but it's not great. And I think, again, the world is much better now in that the amount of masking required is less. But it still is. And so I think what I would say with the benefit of hindsight is just recognize that you need to do that and recognize what it costs you and build in recovery from that, right? So like the example of you're on the spectrum, you have to go out and schmooze with people, okay, you can do that, you can put on the mask for that, you can play that game, but then let yourself go and sit in your darkened room and play, for me it's word puzzles, do your little word puzzles for 2 hours, and by yourself, or do whatever you need, and don't, like the worst part is when you either don't, you deny yourself those recuperative methods, or you allow yourself to do them, but then constantly be like, you know, have this internal voice being like, you weirdo, why do you need this? Like, can't you, you know, like, so don't, like, just, that's who I am. That's what I need. And again, this is something that I think even non-neurodivergent people, you know, could use grace on, because we are all unique, and they, you know, everyone has things where like, okay, this is not working for me, and I have to kind of pretend for a while, but then let yourself do that, and then let yourself recover. Yeah, I guess I was quite inspired by, so I work with someone who's very visually impaired, like, you know, not fully blind, but legal, like very, very visually impaired to the extent that he can't drive and all sorts of things. But I was just really inspired by the, you know, his matter of fact acceptance of this. So this means I can do this and this. This means for this I can accommodate, but I, you know, I need that. And just, he just works it in his life. And, you know, like, I think that's what you have to do for neurodivergence as well. Or, I mean, even non-disability things, like, you know, I have an American accent, so I have to be prepared for occasionally people asking me about Trump and, you know, or, you know, yeah, things like that, you know, everything you have to sort of, okay, this is a fact about me, instead of hating myself for it, let's just adapt. Yeah.
Sounds like, even for non-neurodivergent people, it's really about finding the balance between self-acceptance and self-improvement.
Yeah.
Because if you just try to, I don't know, like schmooze with people and network and whatnot, and that's, you just don't like that. Doesn't matter how much you try, but you know it's important.
Yeah.
And then you don't let yourself do like the puzzles or play video games or go for a run or just be by yourself. Then it's, you're not really accepting yourself. You're trying to improve yourself, but there's things that you just are. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the way I look of it is, you know, what you want to do is you want to figure out how to be the best you. And what that's going to look like is going to be different for everyone. And, you know, I mean, like, conversely, again, I talked about my, you know, my brother. My family's all vaguely non-neurotypical, and he is the least non-neurotypical of us. He's the most neurotypical, right? And I actually think he had a bit of a hard time because of that. Like, he felt an outlier in our family, like, you know, but he loves schmoozing. He's in business now. He was prom king and everything, but he felt bad because of that. And, you know, like, because in our family, he was an outlier. And so for him, it was really good to embrace, no, I can do that. This doesn't make me a bad person, you know. And so it's about sort of figuring out and getting yourself into positions where you can actually be you more, and you need to mask less, while acknowledging that it's inevitable you will have to, by mask I mean just mean pretend to be someone other than yourself, you know, we all have to do it. So it's, there's not a one size fits all, and I think again, even neurotypical people, you have to figure out where do I fit best, you know, and it's about trying to get yourself into environments where you can do that.
Yeah. On a more personal note, is there anything else you would like to say to students entering academia who may be experiencing neurodivergence?
I think, I guess what I would say is kind of similar to what I said last night, which, you know, a lot of people wouldn't necessarily have heard, which is, you do you. And by which I mean, like, so I think it's really good nowadays that we have so much knowledge of different ways of being neurodivergent and also other ways of being marginalized, and there's discussion of that and everything. But I do worry sometimes that because we talk about it so much, it can be easy for people to label themselves and then look and just, you know, track who else has those labels and sort of, and then, first of all, a lot of labels are individual. You don't, you know, you're invisible. You don't know who has them. You know, but even beyond that, because we label, like, having the labels, it can be very, very cognitively easy to reify them as being much bigger deals than they necessarily are or have to be. And so I guess my advice for people is, you know, self-knowledge is great. Understand how you tick. But when you ask yourself, do I fit somewhere? Don't look at how many people who have the exact same label distribution as you are there. First of all, because you don't know necessarily if they do, but also because if they don't, it might be for all sorts of reasons, including no one has even tried, you know, or because of historical factors that were relevant, you know, 20 years ago and aren't relevant now, right? And so don't count yourself out. You do you. Try things, even if you think there's no chance. Almost all the good things in my life have gone because I've managed to shut up the voice saying, why are you doing this, you know? And I'm just like, well, I'll try this. Who cares, right? Just try stuff, I guess. That's my main thing. Try stuff. Some will work, some won't. You'll learn something from it. Far more things will work than you think will. And that goes from, you know, applying to some program you wouldn't think, or asking someone on a date, or, you know, adding bunnies to your statistics subject or whatever. Just try stuff. Yeah.
That's great. Before we wrap up, I did have one final question.
Yeah.
So you were at the Industry Expo last night and you gave a talk and it was really great. And you said things that I were aware about you because I took RMHI, about how you weren't sure that you're going to end up in academia, that you started your undergrad and your whole career progression was kind of like, oh, I guess I'm doing this right now. This is kind of interesting. I don't know what the future will hold, but I like this thing right now. Mm. Let's open this to even people who don't identify as neurodivergent.
Yeah.
Just psychology students or just students in general. I'm sure you know it's a confusing time to be a student. It's always confusing to be a student unless you're like dead set on becoming a clinical psychologist. You don't really know where you're going to be in 10 years, and it might be very terrifying, especially in these times. What is one piece of wisdom or advice you want to tell to such students?
I guess I want to say that I don't know anybody, even the people who at 20 looked like they had everything under control. I don't know anybody who had a linear path. And what that means is you don't need to know. In fact, it's impossible to know where you're going 10, 20 years down the road. Like, it also means, and so that can be kind of terrifying, but, you know, literally everyone does it, which means that that what you want to do is you want to build your resilience skills. It's another overused word, but I mean your skills of handling whatever comes up, right? So instead of thinking, how do I become X thing in 10 years, think, how do I build the skills I need so that whatever happens, I can roll with it? Because that is really, I think that's been actually one of my saving graces, because I've always just been like, okay, whatever. Again, I don't know if this is the ADD, but like, you know, I can roll with whatever came up. And I think this is actually another benefit of, like, I grew up fairly poor. But what that meant is that I took a lot of jobs, kind of shit jobs for a while. Like I worked construction, worked in retail, I did a lot of tutoring, I did, you know, loads of jobs. And what that meant though was that I was a lot less worried about my career than people who, you know, all they had around them was examples in their family of like really high performers and everything. And, you know, and so when you don't see examples of people having crap jobs but still being kind of happy, then it becomes this big unknown. And it wasn't an unknown to me. And I think that gave me actually a lot of resilience to, oh, crappy thing happened. That's okay. I can do this, or I can do this, or I can do this. And so, again, I've totally meandered here, but I what I want, you know, to tell people is, you know, I had that advantage because I saw it early, but that's true for everyone, right? Everyone, it's not going to go to plan, and that's okay, because that's how you learn about yourself, and that's also how you figure out what is, you know, what's the next step, right? So if something doesn't go to plan, that might be because the plan was crap. And there's actually a better step for you, and you have the ability to find that better step and take it. So I guess that, I don't know, I know it's super anxious. A lot of people are super anxious because it's so hard to get into clinical, you know, psych, and there's a lot of reasons to be anxious. But the thing that saved me from anxiety is knowing that, right? Whatever happens, I'll be able to handle it. And I genuinely believe that's true for everyone because they do, right? And most people my age, we look at back ourselves on our 20s and we think I was so much more anxious than I needed to be because, yes, things didn't work out, but I handled them, right? So that's my main thing. You will handle it. Yeah. Again, easy to say. But hopefully that's helpful.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Really. Yeah, so we're just about to wrap up, but we wanted to say thank you for coming here, Andy. Everyone at Moopa loves you. Yeah. When I asked you to come to Industry Expo via email, you noted that you're potentially overstaying your welcome because you already did it in the past. I don't think that'll ever be the case. Aside from the point that there's always new students taking in RMHI, so it wouldn't even apply, or not even RMHI. There's always just new students that don't know you yet. Even us old folks, old 21, 22, 23-year-olds who have been I took RMHI in 2022, and you took it last year or this year?
This semester.
A newbie.
Yeah, I don't think we can.
So did you see Quackers or did I add
it? I did see Quackers.
Okay, Quackers was new in 2022, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, I remember Quackers a lot, Yeah, I don't think we can ever get tired of you.
No, that's really great.
Your content, it's all great.
It's so rewarding, I have to say, doing RMHI. It's my favorite class I've ever taught, and part of it is Bunnyland, but a lot of it is just I love the student response. I love seeing you know, so many people start in February and March being like, what is this? I think I will hate it. And then, you know, not everyone by the end, but a lot of, like, I just love the progression and everything. So thank you for doing that. And honestly, it's really a huge pleasure. So, yeah.
And from the behalf of the cohort, we would also like to thank you for being such an inspirational figure and honestly, a comforting presence.
That's good.
In our 3 to 4 year trek into whatever we're going into the future.
So, yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Like I said, it's a big pleasure that I can do that too. And I mean, honestly, I think, God, younger me would be astonished to hear people say that about me, you know, but it's the power of, you know, leaning into you being you. And so, yeah, that's cool. Thank you.
Yeah. And that just, I think actually brought something to mind that I don't know about other students, but personally, I started RMHI and I didn't particularly dislike statistics. Like, I didn't really care for it, but I didn't actively dislike it like some students. Mm. But I came from an arts background and stats was definitely not my strong suit. Mm. But after RMHI, I actually became really passionate and interested in stats. And I did really well in RMHI. And then I did ADA in honors and I did really well in ADA. And now I'm actually considering, I don't want to become a psychologist, but I'm considering a career in something related to stats and data analysis.
Wow.
And that was actually, that happened just in RMHI. That is kind of like the transition, the pivot point, I guess. And I'm trying to actually be honest with myself. I don't think it's Bunnyland per se. I think it was just your authenticity and charisma and the way you carry that subject. I mean, Bunnyland was good, don't get me wrong, but I think even if you taught it without Bunnyland, I'd still probably have the same response.
No, that's very cool. I mean, I also think some of it is the subject matter in that I think there's, I mean, you know, I'm biased. I love this subject. But I think that especially people from an arts background, like what, you know, so my partner's a mathematician. We have all these conversations about how maths and stats are actually, it's patterns and stories. That's what they actually are. But it's really, you know, it's really not visible that it's that way. And so I think that there's, you know, so what I did right is teaching it so that came out. But what you all did right was picking that up. And because I think that's what probably, you know, if you liked it and you continue to like it, it's not Bunnyland, but it was probably not entirely me either. It's that part of it or some part of it, you know. So, I don't know. Like, again, that's one of the best parts of teaching is when you hear about, you know, people who just, oh, there's this whole new world that I didn't even realize was so cool. And it's like, that is so awesome. Yeah. Yeah.
Where can anyone go to follow up with you or get in contact, find about your work?
pretty much email me, and I think I'm the only Andrew Perforce in the world. So, you know, for better or for worse, you Google me and, you know, you find my webpage and, you know, yeah. But email, and I usually respond to email pretty well. And yeah.
Awesome. Thanks, Andy.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much. Thanks. Have a great day.
Yeah.